On the Bikecast, we bring you interest in our community. Today we have AJ Walkley with us, author of Queer Greer, Vuto, Choice, and a writer for the Huffington Post. AJ is also a powerful force in our bisexual community as an activist. Welcome, AJ.
Thank you. It's so fabulous to be here. I've been so excited about the Bicast ever since it was founded, and it's absolutely an honor.
Well, we're excited about it, too. We're excited about you. You're doing so much right now. It's just
Thank you. Fantastic. Thank you. Yeah, there's a lot to be done, I think, you know?
Yeah. So, AJ, you have a really interesting history. Let's hear a little bit about you and your work.
Absolutely. So, I first came out as bisexual in college after years and years of coming to terms with who I was, and despite kind of pushing my own bisexuality down since I had my first experiences with both with people from across the gender spectrum, honestly, from the age I was probably about 5 onward. But it took me that long to really come to terms with it. And, you know, I got very, very involved in my college's LGBT community. And we spearheaded this mission my junior year called the Fight to Give Life to try to put an end to the FDA ban on men who have sex with men giving blood, which took us all across the country and ended up bringing us actually to D.C. to speak to members of the FDA as well as the blood banks, you know, American Red Cross, America Blood Centers and whatnot. And that really started spearheading my own passion for activism and feeling like I could actually make a difference if I raise my voice loud enough and if I can, you know, be part of a greater community and bring people together. And I've really tried to take that further as I've gone on with my life and graduated from college and becoming much more involved in the bisexual community specifically, especially online through Facebook groups. I've since become one of the board members of Vinet USA, was invited to be one of the 33 activists who were brought to the White House for the first bisexual roundtable last September for Celebrate Bisexuality Day. And it has just been absolutely fabulous connecting with this community, because once you get out of college, and especially I'm now in the Phoenix, Arizona area where there is very little community to speak of, having even a virtual community online is just so valuable and so precious. And getting to know people like you, Lynette, and you, John, has just made my life so much more rich and well off. And on top of the bisexual activism that I love to do on Huffington Post and through the community in general, I'm also an author who has written several books, and the first one of which is Queer Greer, which actually I wrote because I wanted to get a book out there that would have helped me or people like me coming to terms with their sexuality as, you know, teenagers, as college, high school and college students, because when I wrote it, I hadn't found anything out there in the YA fiction world that really spoke to that experience at the time. And I wanted to make sure that there was something out there for people going through their evolutions into discovering themselves that maybe they could take some solace in when they picked up.
Great. I just got through Queer Greer. It's a great coming out novel. It's also the story of Greer, a teenage girl who does seem to have a lot of advantages in life. She comes from a liberal home. She's attractive. She's athletic. But still, she's a kid and still needs her absent parents. One of the themes to me is that teens need adults in their lives, and teens don't always know how to seek it. What is your advice to adults and teens to help make coming out easier?
Absolutely. You know, and like I said, this was not an autobiographical novel, but I definitely took parts of my own life and imbued them into Greer and the situations she gets herself into or she finds herself in the novel. And one of the big aspects is coming out to her family. And I know from my personal experience, when I first came out to my own mother, I did it in a way where I wasn't just, hey, mom, I'm bisexual. It was more of a roundabout way of saying, hi, hey, mom, you know, just so you know, I'm dating someone new and her name is Sarah. And by that time, she had only known me to date cisgender men. That was kind of my way of coming out to her as bi. And in my experience, she ended up actually, her face turned like a stone tablet, and she turned around and walked out of the kitchen where we were standing. And that was the end of that conversation at that point in time. And I realized, like, okay, I've obviously taken a long time to come to terms with who I am and who I am in terms of my sexuality. It's not going to necessarily take my mother, you know, 2 seconds to come to terms with my sexuality mm-hmm. as well. So in the moment, it was a little painful because I almost felt like she was slapping me in the face and saying, like, I don't want to hear this. But looking back on the situation in hindsight, I realized, no, she just needed me to give her the time that I had already had for myself to wrap her mind around what that meant for me, what that might mean for my future. Because as most of us know, you know, our parents have ideas and dreams for us from the time we're born on. And oftentimes when we kind of throw a wrench in those plans, or those assumptions for our futures for them, it does take some time. And I think it's important for the bisexual teen coming, or bisexual youth, or however old you are when you come out to your family or your parents, to realize, you know, you should also allow them the time to process what that means for you and for them. I think that there are obviously certain people in situations where they know that their parents might not take kindly to their sexuality being anything but heterosexual, maybe people who come from particularly religious families, for instance. And in that case, if you are under the assumption that maybe the reaction is going to be negative, maybe even to the point of being kicked out of the house, I would say to first try to find people outside of your family to come out to, and to really strengthen your own identity, to be also to have a support network around you, so that in the off chance that you are kicked out, or you have a falling out with your family when you do come out, you have people in your life who you can then go to and take solace in, who will take you in. And I think it's the support network is so key. And I think it's difficult for a lot of bisexuals, especially in more conservative areas of the country or the world, who don't necessarily have that community. And that's why for me specifically, once I got out of college and ended up in Arizona, I really focused on the online community because it's so rich. We have such amazing people who are doing such amazing things, and it's all online. You know, we can connect. You know, we're connecting now over the internet, which is fabulous. And I think taking advantage of those online communities can also be really helpful, not even only for the bisexual coming out, but even for their family. If you know, there are so many resources out there with information about what it means to have your child come out to you, that I think it's important for the bisexual teen or the bisexual youth to kind of have those resources at the ready to give to their parents and say, listen, I know that this is going to take you potentially some time to understand and to get your mind around. In the meantime, you know, check out this website, check out this article. It's going to help you understand where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I'd like to elaborate a little bit. Because, you know, Greer's mom, Karen, like, mm-hmm. her best friends are lesbians. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and yet she has trouble, right? Right. And yes. It's really, for her, it's about fear. And it's right. about, you know, the kind of, the fear that, you know, parents have all these fears about their kids. And, you know, I thought it was really real the way mm-hmm. that she dealt with it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that she hated LGBT people.
Right.
It was more that she feared for her daughter's safety. Mm-hmm. And,
right.
you know, this I'm not going to give too many spoilers, but it comes at a point in which Greer has a little bit of bashing happening to her.
Right.
So it's, you know, it's actually a really great piece of the book. You know, my dad taught me how to box when I was 10, mm-hmm. mainly because he was trying to keep me safe.
Right.
So, you know, that's how parents deal with it sometimes.
Absolutely. And that was very, actually very apropos to my own situation. My mom, one of her college roommates is gay. She is one of her great friends. I grew up, you know, knowing her and loving her. And yet, which made me feel like, oh, she's totally going to understand. She's totally going to get it. You know, she's a very liberal person, which threw me for a loop when her first reaction was not complete acceptance. It was a little bit of a balking, like, I can't deal with this right now. And eventually we would get into conversations where I realized, yes, the issue at hand for her was more that she didn't want me to be discriminated against. She didn't want me to be harassed. She didn't want me to potentially be the victim of any kind of violence. And it was really about fearing for my safety and my well-being more than being upset about my sexuality.
But I really relate to Greer on a very personal level for all the things you guys are talking about. And because, well, she went further than I ever did as a child. But I, you know, like I said, around 6 years old, my first love was, you know, Audrey Hepburn. Mm-hmm. And that should have been a clue, you know. And then, of course, I was mad in love with Richard Chamberlain. But, you know, and there was a couple of boys I was, you know, crushed on a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, then I had a series of girls that if I had known what it was, I was mad in love with. They could do no wrong. Mm-hmm. They were perfect.
Right.
And it was different than a girlfriend situation altogether, as, you know, a best friend situation, because I never felt like that about them.
Right.
I mean, they were my friends.
Right.
But we didn't have any that kind of language or books like this. And the language about bisexuals was very bad mm-hmm. growing up. So, you know, it was a whole lifetime of me relearning what I was really all about and accepting that. And, you know, I commend you on having this book available for our young people now to show them, you know, that they're okay, that they're not broken. And it's not, you know, a crime,
right?
A moral crime, you know, to feel the things they feel. So, you know, I commend you for that. And I also want to commend you for your work that you were talking about the blood.
Yes.
This is something that John has a lot of experience on.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
yeah. I'll put in my 2 cents that I always do is, you know, our son had a bone marrow transplant when he was 15,
mm-hmm.
Aplastic anemia, which is a bone marrow failure disease. And both me and my partner, because we're banned from giving blood, couldn't give blood. And, you know, my son went through blood banks of blood. I mean, we were at a point for a year and a half, even post-transplant, of getting red blood just about every 2 weeks.
Wow.
And so, you know, I would love to give blood. I mean, we want
nice.
To. And, you know, we're banned from it. And it's kind of crazy, you know. I'll take a test every month to let mm-hmm. them know that I'm still negative and my partner
right.
is still negative.
It's so antiquated. You know, they just haven't changed the policy since the big AIDS scare of the 80s. And that's mm-hmm. where it all stems from. And despite the fact that our testing has significantly improved over that time, and we have these, you know, safe mechanisms in place to assure that the blood is being tested correctly and is safe for use. And especially in your case, John, where you want to donate to your son, it just boggles my mind that you wouldn't be able to do that. It's insane.
It is insane.
And my partner, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And your partner.
And,
yeah.
you know, I think at least in the gay blood drive, I try to, like, tell them that, you know, it's not just gay people. You know, my partner is pretty close to 100% heterosexual, and she can't give blood just by being with me for all these years.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I would love to, I relate to Greer on a personal level, and I really would love to see her story unfold further. Is there anything on the horizon, maybe about her in her later life? I mean, as a possibility?
Absolutely. Yeah, I've actually been thinking and kind of outlining in my mind, and I started to outline on paper as well, the sequel to Queer Greer, which will take her into college. And the thing that, looking back on Queer Greer, the novel itself, from when I wrote it right out of college, is the fact that I really, it, it, comes across as a very binary view of bisexuality, which is not necessarily what I intended. And that's why I would really like to create the sequel where I'm thinking it's tentatively called Straight Nate, actually. And we follow her into college, and she becomes a secondary character to the protagonist of Nate, who we meet as Natalie. And I want to imbue this trans character as one of Greer's true loves in her life. And I want to get across the fact that the binary of bisexuality is not a binary of male versus female, but it's of being attracted to people who are the same as us and who are different from us, which is, again, a stereotype that I think a lot of people mistake bisexuality for. There's this overall view of the sexuality that, oh, bisexuals only are attracted to cisgender men and cisgender women, which is not, in effect, the actual definition of bisexual. And that's something that I know, I'm sure both of you have encountered as well. But one of the prevailing myths, which ends up creating so many other terms under the so-called bisexual umbrella, pansexual, sexual fluidity and whatnot, all of which are absolutely fabulous terms and everyone should be able to self-identify any way they wish. But I would personally like to get across the fact that for myself and for the character of Greer, bisexual really means being able to be attracted to anyone across the entire gender spectrum. And that's what I'd like to imbue in her in the sequel.
Oh, thank great. You. Please do that. Yeah.
I mean, we have in my local group so many, especially women who went, some even went to, women's colleges with really, really long queer histories in them. Mm-hmm. And, being bisexual meant that at best they found the other community, right? They found the friends that, were, and a lot of times trans, that didn't fit into the LGBT college world.
Right.
So it would be helpful for them, I think, in some ways too.
Right.
To see that those possibilities exist, and for kids going into college to like say, hey, yeah, if the LGBT college community is, very identity driven, mm-hmm. LG, here's what you do.
Right. Yeah.
Before we start talking about Vuto, I just want to bring up choice. I don't think we mentioned that yet. I want to mention it because I also relate to this very strongly because of my own events in my own life very early on, mm-hmm. at the age of 15. If I had made a different choice, what my life would have been like.
Right.
And, well, personally, I don't think it would have been very much better. In fact, I probably would have self-destructed at a much earlier age. And, of course, I wouldn't have what I have in my life. But these are things that, come up for young people, girls and boys, mm-hmm. put in these situations. And I really am enjoying the book.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. Yeah, mm-hmm. I actually self-published that book, and what I'm hoping to do with that down the line is actually to take it off of the self-publishing site that it's on, rework it so that instead of the two stories that I tell, because as it stands right now, Choice is told with two different endings. The first tells the story of Haley Fry when she gets pregnant and chooses to end the pregnancy and what her, mm-hmm. life would be like. And the second half tells what her life would be like if she kept the pregnancy to term. And what I'd like to do is to add a third section where she chooses to go the adoption route as well, which is not something, yes. that I had considered when I first wrote it. And I had since spoken to a lot of people who wish that had also been explored. So I'm hoping that down the line I can do that as well for her.
Yes, because I've known a lot of girls in my same position at that time, and many of them did go that route. Hmm. And their experience was intense and heartbreaking. Yes. And I commend their bravery even to this day.
Mm. Yes.
But yeah, that would be great to have that, have that view of it, have, yes. that voice for that.
Absolutely.
Oh, great. Well, let's go to Voto.
Voto.
Voto. Voto. I love Sam's journey through the African jungle to save Voto from trouble. The points of view give each character a voice, and it shows that each have their own understanding of the event. There's also a seemingly unreconcilable gap between Western ideas of feminism and the society aid groups are trying to help. Could you talk about your experience in the Peace Corps? Are you involved in any of these policy changes now?
Absolutely. Growing up, and especially my high school experience, when I was really starting to understand what activism meant and having this feeling like I wanted to help people, but not really understanding what that meant as, you know, a white liberal girl from America, the Peace Corps sounded like a fabulous way to start doing something like that after college. So that had just, I'd always been on a one-track mind. After college, I was going into the Peace Corps no matter what. And I went through the whole application process, and I was given the assignment to be a health volunteer in Malawi, Africa. And when I went into it with a lot of blinders on, which I think a lot of volunteers do, because you're not told exactly what it's actually like on the ground in the countries that you're going to be stationed in. And unless you know volunteers who have been there in the past to speak to you about it, you're going to go in somewhat blind. And the problem that I had with the Peace Corps is the fact that they put you through a pretty good training. And that was probably the best part of my experience there, especially with my homestay family and really getting to know the community and the villagers. But once the training's over, you're basically put into a village by yourself and told good luck, and you're left there. And as a white girl from America, being the only white person in a village where most people have never seen a white person on a day-to-day basis, it can put you in a very vulnerable situation, especially when you're alone. And I was very confused about the fact that I wasn't being stationed with at least one other volunteer simply for safety's sake. And you're sent there, you're not even given any way to necessarily call back to headquarters. If you want a cell phone, for instance, you have to buy it yourself out of your own pocket, which can be kind of pricey in these areas. My parents were adamant that I do that, so they bought me one. But even then, communication isn't guaranteed. You know, the power lines go down all the time. So I started to feel very unsafe, especially when people started stealing things out of my hut when I wasn't there. And when I went to headquarters to talk to them about my safety concerns, they basically told me, well, you can just stay there or you can leave. You can go home. You can go back to the U.S. And I was so angry. I mean, I had been dreaming about this opportunity for so long, and for them to basically say, we don't really care about your safety issues, you can either suck it up and hope for the best and that nothing negative is going to happen, or leave altogether after they put me through all this training, invested in my training, invested in getting me over to the country to begin with, it didn't compute to me. And I really wanted to kind of get that through in my novel of Voto through the character of Sam and some of the other volunteers that we meet along the journey. The fact that these are mostly college graduates right out of school who are being put into situations in countries they've never been into, trained for about, you know, 8 weeks if most. You know, I was an English major in college, and yet I was a health volunteer in Malawi, and that a lot of that had to do with my own interest in the fight against HIV and AIDS, but I had no medical background. I had no health background whatsoever. So all I had was these 2 months of training where when I was left in the village, I didn't really feel capable of doing much of anything. And actually, when I was there, the villagers who I was trying to work with, they didn't even feel like they needed help with the health side. They really needed wells dug. And I didn't know how to dig a well. Sure, they kind of showed us how to do it in our training, but for one single person to be able to create an entire well, especially somebody who's an English grad, you know, major graduate right out of college, I was not the right person to be building wells whatsoever. So there's definitely this disconnect between what you're going there and thinking you're going to be doing versus what the community actually needs and what you're actually going to be able to accomplish. And then in terms of, you know, talking about policy changes, I have been very involved, or as involved as I can be, with this group that is becoming more and more well known in the U.S. called Health Justice for Peace Corps Volunteers. And the reason that I became involved with them is because Megan, my volunteer friend throughout training, she is unable to work anymore since she contracted a virus in Malawi through the water that has created a slew of symptoms that has basically turned her from a 29-year-old girl into an 80-year-old. She has cyclical vomiting syndrome. She has short-term memory loss. She can't sit up or stand up for more than 2 hours at a time without taking a nap because it just drains her. She can never, ever hold a job in her life. And she is dependent on now her parents and her family to support her. And what has the U.S. government done? Absolutely nothing. She has been met with red tape at every single turn to try to get her medical bills paid for. You know, it's just, it's astounding to me how wonderful Americans who volunteer their time, their, you know, years of their life, if not their lives and their well-being, at the end of the day, to do something that they think is good for their country as well as the country that they're going to serve in. And yet when they come back, if they're sick, if they're injured in any way, shape, or form, if they've been sexually assaulted, they're basically being forsaken by the government. And I can say that the new Peace Corps director is trying to have much more open dialogue with Health Justice for Peace Corps Volunteers to hopefully get their needs met. But as I'm sure both of you know, things with the government usually take a very, very long time if they ever are accomplished whatsoever. So while there is some hope there, it's a slim hope at this point.
Yeah.
But there is hope. Keep at it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, really, like, Peace Corps volunteers and AmeriCorps volunteers, you know, are veterans.
Right.
You know, and they should have the same kind of rights and privileges that any other of our veterans do.
Yes.
It's sad that they don't. I have some history with development work and, mm-hmm. you know, and in DC, there's a lot of returned Peace Corps volunteers who I know because of activist work. First, it's a life changing experience for people. And probably for you and for a lot of others, it's not the life-changing experience that you thought you were going to get when you signed up.
Right, right. And I think there's also this prevailing notion of kind of the white savior complex, so to speak, where Americans are going into countries they've never been before and they really don't know much about, trying to save third world country villagers, third world country individuals, which is not necessarily a good thing all of the time. You know, I went in there, I had no idea about the cultural traditions that were really preventing certain changes from taking place, like wife inheritance, where if a man dies, say, from an AIDS-related complication, his wife is then inherited by another male member of his family, and if she has also contracted AIDS, she's going to then give it to that other male member and possibly his wife as well. And these are things where you can't just say you have to stop wife inheritance. That's not going to happen because what's the alternative? These women end up on the streets begging and could be raped, could be assaulted, could be killed. You know, so it's not a cut and dry situation in any way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. And yet a lot of the times the aid workers going into these countries are told that it is that cut and dry and they're met with resistance and issues at every turn. And the progress that they thought they were going to make is ineffectual completely.
Yeah. Yeah. We actually had a project in Nicaragua some years back for sewage and, you know, the raw sewage in this community. And what was funny about it was that Contras and Sandinistas who lived in that same community worked together to, you know, dig latrines and to build the project because, you know, at the end of the day, for them, it didn't matter if you were right wing or left wing. Everybody needed to have a clean sanitation system in their village.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're an activist for the bisexual community. We are, and we're happy you are, like you said.
Thank you.
And besides your great books, you do a lot of work as activists. Can you just give us an idea of what that would be?
Absolutely. I try to take the opportunity to speak at events as much as possible. I've spoken at the Trevor Project. They had a wonderful event in New York last year on bisexuality, and I was one of the speakers at that event. I've spoken at Models of Pride, which is a Southern California-based conference for LGBT youth. And that any time I can get the chance to speak in front of youth, I always take it because it's absolutely wonderful to see the changes that are taking place in the generations that are coming from behind us, because I think there's a lot more acceptance going on. There's a lot more understanding about minority sexualities. And for instance, the last time I spoke at Models of Pride, just about a year and a half ago, there was one person in the audience who was confused by my use of the word bisexual, considering that I was talking about having attractions to people across the gender spectrum, because she was like, well, but I'm pansexual and that's what I am. Like, that's the word I use. And it turned into this fabulous conversation with terms and terminology and labels and how, you know, obviously there are so many that could apply to so many of us. Technically, I could consider myself pansexual as well. And it kind of turned into this idea of, you know what, there's a reason that we have these certain kind of umbrella terms, because it can get a little out of control pretty fast when you get LGBTQPRTVZ. You know, you could literally make that acronym about 50 letters long, and I'm sure it would not even fully encompass everybody under the so-called umbrella. But I love having these conversations with the youth, because they get it, and they're getting it more and more than older generations are. So that's fabulous. And on top of that, I also really enjoy speaking at PFLAG events, because I think the PFLAG organization still has a lot of work to do in terms of bisexual awareness and understanding. I spoke with a group in Tucson, Arizona, a couple of years ago, and they told me I was the first bisexual they've ever met, which really surprised me, because I said I'm pretty sure that's not true, but
But you met a lot of them,
right? It was a great open discussion about what bisexuality meant and how, you know, explaining to them that I'm pretty sure that you probably do know a lot more bisexuals, but it can be very difficult for us to come out, especially when we have to come out all the time, a lot of us, as opposed to coming out once as, you know, an LG person in many circumstances. So that's also, you know, an opportunity that I like to take advantage of when it comes my way. I also write for Bi Magazine, which is put out by the American Institute of Bisexuality. And I've been tapped to do a lot more interviews recently. And I think it has to do a lot with the Cosmopolitan piece that just came out this month, August 2014, on bisexual women's health. And I was one of a handful of activists who were interviewed for the piece. And that's seen a lot of really great play, both online and in the media. I think a lot of people have been more understanding of the health issues that surround bisexuality because of that piece. And it's fabulous that it was featured in such a widespread magazine that's read by so many people.
I was really happy to see that in Cosmopolitan.
Yeah.
It's very encouraging.
And you sold out of the print copy of Queer Greer, didn't you?
Right, I did. Yes. I was actually really surprised by that.
Yes. Talk about Bowls of Love a little bit. I saw a little bit about your work in that cookbook, but elaborate, please.
Yeah. So one of my friends from high school, who we had actually lost touch over the years, she had approached me last year. We were talking about Kickstarter, since I funded Vuto through Kickstarter, and she has this blog called sopaleo.blogspot.com that I had turned to when I was trying to get some health issues of mine under control. I loved her site. She has some fabulous recipes that are really wonderful to check out. And I encouraged her to turn it into a cookbook, because I thought that a lot of people would especially in the climate now, in terms of health being such a big deal in the U.S. in terms of obesity rates and the like. I thought that it would be a really awesome cookbook, and I actually helped come up with the idea for the title of Bowls of Love. She's reached out to 50 of her friends and family to donate a bowl that means something to them, that expresses themselves in some way. And she created a unique paleo soup recipe for each person in the book. And technically the full book name is Bowls of Love, Paleo Soups for the Seasons. And it's segmented in, you know, fall, winter, spring, summer. So, you know, you can kind of go by what the seasonal fruits and veggies are that you can pick up in your, you know, local farmer's market, your local grocery store. And I have just had such a fabulous time helping her work on these little stories for each of the people that the recipes are dedicated to. And I'm really excited for it to come out later this fall.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Right. So what is your recipe?
Oh, my recipe, actually. Hopefully Allie doesn't get mad at me for spoiling the surprise for this one. But she actually created a recipe that's very akin to the Malawian recipe that I created for my Kickstarter backers. It's a chicken curry soup-esque soup. Because for my backers last year, I created a traditional Malawian meal of curried chicken, because there's an Indian influence that can be seen in the cities of Malawi that I wanted to get across, and chicken curry is absolutely delicious. So I'm really excited to be making that soup in the this coming winter.
Yeah, you had me at curry.
There you go.
Yeah, I could do a mock chicken for it, I guess.
There you go. Yeah,
you could. Totally. There you go, John. Yeah. So let's not forget you work with Transgender Violence Tracking Portal and Binet USA.
Right. So yeah. Transgender Violence Tracking Portal, this project from Allison Wolbert really struck my heart last year when she approached me to write something for Huffington Post about her Kickstarter for this portal. It is so needed, because there has never before been one central hub to record, sadly, all of the horrendous, horrendous states of violence that occur against trans and genderqueer people across the globe, really, on a daily, if not, you know, hourly basis, sadly to say. And this portal is already doing such fabulous work. You know, it's collecting data from people globally about different issues that they see in terms of everything from bullying to rape, to assault, to murder, everything in between that occurs against trans individuals. And I think it's really important to have this site and this resource to be able to accurately record statistics about that, to hopefully facilitate change, whether it be just in terms of public awareness or policy changes that will hopefully lead to more protections against trans individuals moving forward.
Yeah. We very much back Allison and her project.
I've been a backer of her since she started too. And in DC just a few days ago, mm-hmm. on my metro line, and you know, the perpetrator actually got on at the same stop that I get on.
Oh, wow.
Stabbed a trans 15-year-old child on the metro. And so it really hits very close to home.
Right.
I mean, yeah. Everybody did what they needed to in that situation. There were passengers like hitting the emergency button and giving a good description, and he was caught in the station.
Good.
But it's scary, and it happens. Yes. You know, it happens. You know, in Baltimore, there have been two trans women who have been murdered in the last few months. And we just had we just passed our trans inclusive non-discrimination law, and mm-hmm. there was a petition campaign, and the campaign to put our trans protection bill on the ballot, there was a lot of transphobic rhetoric being used in it.
Mm.
And you know, I blame the senator from like the way far out part of Maryland for a lot of it, you know, this kind of violence, because, you know, it's that kind of transphobic rhetoric that crazy people hear and they act out on it.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So hopefully, you know, this portal will collect all of this information and moving forward, we can hopefully see these statistics start to fall. That is obviously the goal, but I think it's going to take a lot more public awareness and public education about transgender individuals and trans issues and what it means to be transgender, because sadly, I think a lot of people just don't understand what it is and who these people are and what their experiences are and just what being a transgender person means. And it's not anything to be afraid of. It's not anything to feel like they're discriminating against you or your gender for you know, expressing themselves. And yet I think those are prevailing myths and ideas about for certain people that it's somehow these people's gender is impacting mine. Similarly to, you know, well, if you're bisexual, well, that doesn't make sense. You need to be in one box or the other.
Yeah. You're threatening my, born this way thing, which I still don't understand that concept at all. What does that mean? I'm threatening that, you know?
It's bizarre.
Things like the tracking project actually can help get this data to law enforcement. And that's an important piece of it. Absolutely. When we had a series of trans hate crimes in DC a few years ago. And it was really because activists had data on every incident that the police could go and actually do their work and catch the people responsible. So that's what these things need to be doing.
Right. Absolutely.
I also think it helps because I have a concern about incidences being concentrated in one geographical area. Mm-hmm. Because in tune to the gay bashing, maybe there is a groups of people, you know, perpetrating these acts.
Yeah.
And that, you know, we need to be aware of that. We need to be fighting that too. You know, if it's come some like a gang of guys that go around doing this in a certain area, you know, that needs to. And so that's one of the things that I like about the project, because it shows what's going on in a certain area.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes maybe we need to go back to the old days where we had whistles. DuPont Circle, and we had gay bashing in the 80s, and basically everybody had a whistle on them, and if something was going on, everybody would start blowing their whistles and attracting attention and stopping the crime and catching the perpetrators, and I don't know, maybe doing a little bit more in some cases to the perpetrators, but you know, they deserved it.
Well, you know it's karma. You put that stuff out there, you're gonna got to pay the price for it.
Yeah.
You know, that's an excellent idea, John. I hadn't even thought about that. I forgot about that. I think I'll go buy a whistle now.
Well, Lizzie Borden's movie with the lesbians on bikes is like such a great scene.
Yeah. Hey, it can't hurt, right? Can't hurt.
Yeah, can't hurt. Okay. One big problem with great novels you've written is the distribution problem.
Mm-hmm.
These are all works that need to be read by more people. Can you talk about the work that goes into public publicity in the small press world? I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. Publicity is probably the hardest part of the whole writing process, if you can even call it part of the writing process. I think especially for a lot of writers who go the indie publishing route, who don't have a large publishing company and a PR firm backing them. It's all very, very grassroots. And I think that's why, you know, the way I've gone with my novels, I've invested a lot of money into them and I haven't seen the return on them yet. And part of that is my own fault because I keep donating my books, but I think I think it's important to get them into people's hands. You know, I didn't go into writing any of my novels in the hopes of making $1 million. It was all about writing about important topics that I wanted people to read about and that I thought could help educate certain people or help other people feel less alone in what they were experiencing. So I just want to get them into people's hands. I want people to read them. And as a result, it means that I've kind of gone into my own pockets a little more than I expected to, but I think that's okay. And I'm okay with it. I just hope, you know, moving forward, maybe there will be better avenues for me to go down publicity wise. If I can find the time to do it, it's kind of hard, you know, when you have a day job and you do all of your activism work and you're blogging for free for Huffington and whatnot, you know, there's only so many hours in a day to then dedicate to publicizing, my novels. But I think, especially with social media and communities online and just kind of tapping into different areas through the internet, honestly, through Facebook, through different online channels to get to where the readers are in the specific genres that I write in. I think Goodreads is a great, great site for trying to get dialogue going around a certain novel or a certain theme. I think that, you know, especially, you know, BuyNet USA, the Buy Activist group on Facebook, being able to talk about, you know, my queer career book, for instance, in those channels is always fabulous because I know that those are the people that I wanted to write the book for. So I think a harder thing to go about is finding a wider audience, because I know I really feel like Vuto can be of interest to a wide variety of people for multiple reasons. And I think I've had the most issues getting that book into the right avenues just because I'm not really sure how to go about it. And I could use a little help. You know, I'm not a marketing person per se. I'm a writer. So the marketing aspect of the book business is definitely the most difficult part for me.
Well, I hear you have a literary agent now. Congrats.
I do. Thank you.
Can you give us a sneak peek into your current novel? And I know a little bit about it.
Yeah. So my fourth novel that will hopefully be coming out in the not so distant future is based on the life story of a woman I've been writing to who is incarcerated in a Texas prison. She was convicted of the murder of her son when she was back in 2002. And after writing to her, I had actually reached out to her over a site called writeaprisoner.com. I was looking for the subject matter of my next book. I had just finished writing Choice, and coming from a family of lawyers, my father is a criminal defense attorney, I've always had a justice kind of upbringing. Justice has always been a part of my life, fighting for the underdog, making sure, you know, the criminal defender or the criminal is defended in the best way possible with the best representation. It's just been kind of ingrained in me since I was born, honestly. And so I wanted to go that route with my next book, and I wanted to get the perspective of a female in prison, because I felt like at that point we really didn't see it. Obviously now we have Orange is the New Black, which is fabulously popular and for all the right reasons, which is wonderful. But back then all I could really think about in terms of the story of a woman behind bars was Monster with Charlize Theron. And I was like, that's not enough. I know that there are so many more stories to be told here. And I wanted to get the perspective of somebody who's actually been through the system and knows what it's like. So I was like, why not get a pen pal? And I found this woman through this website. She was one of very few white women on the page, which kind of made her stick out to me. And I was intrigued when I looked into her profile and it said that she was convicted of murder. It didn't give any other details other than her conviction. So I reached out and started to write to her. And after about 4 months of letter writing back and forth, I really started to get the feeling like she did not commit the crime that she was convicted of. I thought she was wrongfully incarcerated. And so this project kind of took on a life of its own as it went from me just using her as a source of information and somebody who could kind of give me a background of what it's like to be in the prison system as a female to trying to actually get her out. So I started to write to the Innocence Project on her behalf. I had her write to the Innocence Project as well, so we could kind of flood them with letters and get their attention. I reached out to Nancy Grace to try to get her team to look into it. And they, sadly, they didn't look into it very well, but I guess I'm not that surprised because, I don't know, I have conflicting feelings about Nancy Grace as a person. But I've kind of tried to form this into not just a project of fiction, but based on a true story, truly. And the novel has taken on a completely different path from where I started. I must have 50 different versions of this book at this point because I've been writing it and rewriting it for 5 years now. And I'm really excited about where it is now. It is going to be completely fictionalized in the fact that, you know, everybody's name will be changed, certain locations and timelines will be changed to protect the identities of the people involved. But I'm really hoping that once this comes out, it will get the publicity it deserves simply so that Elizabeth's case will be retried. And, you know, the Innocence Project of Texas has been looking into it and investigating it for about 2 years now, which is a fabulous, fabulous sign that there's something, there definitely is something off, because if they didn't think so, they would have dropped the case a long time ago. So I'm really excited about it. I know my agent is super excited about it. And Elizabeth, my friend in prison, is excited about it as well. She has been working on this hand in hand with me, looking at draft after draft to make sure I get everything as clear and truthful as I possibly can in a work based on a true story.
Great, great. It's an issue that is really, well, on my back porch a lot of times.
Really?
Our close friend was the first DNA exoneree in the United States.
For
a murder he had nothing to do with. My partner murdered the death penalty in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it took a long time. It was it was fighting and kicking and screaming, but finally we abolished capital punishment here. So
fabulous. Absolutely wonderful.
Well, you keep us posted on. Let us know if there's anything that the general public can do to help you with that.
Well, thank
please.
You. I absolutely will.
And you know, I have my criminal justice contacts that can be very helpful and maybe get around the few hoops that you might be facing because, you know, I have big people in my corner.
I like the sound of that. I'll be reaching out to you, John.
And he's not fibbing either, so. Thank you. Well, we just can't wait to see what you give us next. And we just had a really stellar year so far in the bisexual community. And we have many great things to come, and you're a big part of that. So keep us posted on everything.
Absolutely.
Anything you'd like to add, AJ?
I just want to thank you both and, you know, thank the bi-cast and the bisexual community out there. I feel so embraced and loved by you all, and I, in turn, love you all more than I can properly convey. I just, you all make my life worthwhile, and I don't know what I would do without you. And I love you guys. That's it.
Yeah,
I love you. If you need a reader, you know, just send me a draft of your book.
I'll
read and pass it around and like get you some help if you need it.
Wonderful.
Yeah, you know, and you know, in the famous words of Terry Garr, the feeling's mutual.
Thank you.
John, can you add anything else?
No, I'm just so tickled that we
I know
did this today.
Yeah.
Because AJ is like such a great writer. Everybody has to just go to Amazon and buy her books and read them, and you will agree.
Thank you so much.
All right, everybody, I want you to remember you are not wrong, you are not broken, and you are not alone. You're a human being, and you are bisexual. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Yeah, I just want to add this update from Camille from BOP. And this comes in from Camille Holthouse from the Bisexual Organizing Project. She just wanted to mention that they have brought Ben Blanchard on board as a contracted volunteer coordinator, and he will be organizing their volunteer database, good, coordinating the interests of the volunteers with the programs and allowing the BOP to staff the programs they've been wanting to offer. Fantastic. So congratulations to you guys.
Great, great. We're moving forward.
Absolutely. We are. All right. Thank you, hon. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Okay?
Bye.
Yeah.
Bye.
It's great. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you. Oh, such really? A pleasure. Want to do it again?
We will. Oh, we definitely will.
Okay. Awesome.
This is Saint Zero from The Headphone Bleed, and you're listening to The Bicast. Symptoms may include an open mind, sense of community, shinier hair, and whiter teeth.
Results may vary.
You can catch me every Saturday night at www.live365.com/stations/Saint Zero.
The views expressed on the Bicast do not necessarily represent those of Binet USA or the Bicast crew.